Welcome to the Sunken Road on Fredericksburg Battlefield. My name is John Hennessy. I'm the chief historian at Fredericksburg and Spotsylvania National Military Park. You may have already taken the podcast tour of the Sunken Road with Frank O'Reilly. If you haven't done that, you should, certainly. Frank's approach was to look at the Sunken Road within the context of the battle itself. Today, I'm going to take the same walk along the Sunken Road, but with a different perspective. A different lens on the road. We're going to look at the Sunken Road as a home place, as a neighborhood that was transformed by the experience of battle. We'll look at the people who live here, the houses that stood here, and their experiences on that day in December of 1862. The Sunken Road is one of the most famous military features in all the world. If you say Sunken Road to anyone who knows anything about the Civil War, they generally think Fredericksburg right away. But the Sunken Road was also a home. In fact, it was a pretty cohesive neighborhood, one of the first suburbs of the town of Fredericksburg, which lay about a half mile off to the east. The people who lived here in 1861, most of them had lived here for a long time. They probably knew each other extremely well. Their lives were completely disrupted by what took place here on December 13th. What we'll do today is a leisurely walk of 8 stops, leaving from the visitor center, down the Sunken Road, and back. Very simple. Start the tour by entering the road at its south end, the end by the National Cemetery. And once you get there, pause there and turn your machine back on. You should now be standing in front of the National Cemetery at the south end of the famous Sunken Road. The scene at this spot on December 11, 1862, was vivid and sad. Jane Beale, who was a schoolteacher in town, passed down the Sunken Road as she fled the prospect of battle in her hometown. She passed over this spot and then continued along the road around the hill that now houses the National Cemetery. Just beyond the hill, she described what she saw. Refugees, dozens of them. Huddling in safety, trying to stay warm on a cold winter's night, fearful at the prospect of battle. The events of that day transformed how we see the Sunken Road. But bear in mind that before the Civil War, the Sunken Road was like tens of thousands of roads elsewhere in America. Traffic of all kinds passed up and down the road. Farmers bringing their goods to market. Slaves passing to and from town. People traveling into the countryside to see relatives, freight bound for Fredericksburg, hauled along by teams of horses pulling massive wagons. These were scenes common in America, and indeed the Sunken Road was, until December 13, 1862, just another road. We can't be sure just how old the road that we know as the Sunken Road really is. It's likely that it dates to colonial times. We do know that by the 1830s, this was a busy thoroughfare, as traffic moved from Fredericksburg out into Spotsylvania County toward Four Mile Fork, and eventually either south to Richmond, or, after 1839, to the new courthouse at Spotsylvania. In fact, most people before the Civil War called this the Courthouse Road. It was also often referred to as Telegraph Road. Later on, the Telegraph Road would become the main connecting route between Washington, D.C. and Richmond. This was, just before the war, part of that road. In fact, it was the I-95 of its day. A busy place, a busy road. Now, before we start down the road to begin to look at some of the sites and the homes that stood along it, I want to point out to you here that we're standing almost next to the site of what was the Hall House. Now, there's only a single photograph of this house. It appears in a photograph that you'll see a little bit farther down the trail. It was a small, modest home. Most people at the time did not live in the big mansions like Brompton or Chatham, but rather in modest one- or two-story frame houses. And such was the case for Joseph Hall, his wife Jane, and their 4 children. The house stood just this side of where the visitor center stands today. The lot was surrounded by a plank fence, 5 rails high. When the Confederates arrived here just before the battle, they immediately dismantled that fence for firewood. Joseph Hall had two-horse wagon loads worth of clover, 4,000 pounds of clover, stored in his lot. And in the barn, he had two loads of oats, 1,500 pounds, and 7 barrels of corn. All of this, probably the yield of a season's farming, was all gone before the battle even started, taken to feed Confederate horses. On December 13, 1862, we don't believe the Halls were actually in the house. They had fled like most civilians did. During the battle, Confederate sharpshooters got into the upper reaches of the house. In fact, one Union soldier remembered seeing a Confederate sharpshooter continually poking his gun out one of the windows in the upper story of the Hall house. This Union soldier described his repeated efforts to shoot that Confederate sharpshooter, trying to time his shots to the appearance of the unfortunate Confederate. In fact, at one point, the Yankee soldier remembered that suddenly the Confederate appeared when the Union soldier still had his ramrod in his gun. He went ahead and fired his gun anyway and watched the ramrod sail through the air and through the upper window of the Hall house. With what effect on the Confederate, we do not know. We don't know much about what happened to Joseph Hall and his family during or after the battle. We do know that the house was largely a wreck. In the tax records for 1865, the Hall house is listed as having been destroyed in the battle. We know it still stood, but in fact it was probably ravaged beyond the point of being usable. Now pause here for a second and move to the next track on your player. Play the next track as you walk leisurely down the road northward on the sunken road. Our next stop will be at the first exhibit you encounter on the right-hand side. As you walk along the road here, just a few observations as we go. First off, the stone walls. The stone wall to your right as you walk along was actually a replacement wall built in the 1930s by Civilian Conservation Corps workers hired by the federal government during the Depression. It is, we now know, a very poor reproduction of what the original stone wall looked like here. This represents something of a challenge to the National Park Service. Now that we know that we have a wall on this spot that is not an accurate representation of what was here, but still, this wall is historic in its own right, built by workers during the Great Depression. Do we keep it? Do we replace it? That's a question we'll be looking at and answering in the coming years. Now, the walls along the road are something of a mystery. If you're from Fredericksburg, you know that there are virtually no stone walls in this region. Exactly why the owner of the properties on both sides of this wall, John Spotswood Welford, decided to build a freestanding, cut, dry-laid stone wall in the 1830s here is a mystery. If he was trying to restrain livestock, he could have done it with a $50 fence. Instead, he built a substantial wall the entire length of his land holdings along what is today the sunken road. His son later said that the stone from the wall was discarded from nearby quarries and that Welford simply gathered it up to build the new walls that lined the road. Originally, there were walls on both sides of the road. To your right is the wall that would ultimately protect the Confederates on December 13, 1862. If you look closely in the base of the hill to your left, the base of Willis Hill, you can see occasionally the footers of the wall that stood there before the Civil War. This wall, we know, was removed before the war. So it was, in fact, in place only for a matter of 20 years or so. Why it was put there, why it was removed, we can't be certain. By now, you should be at the exhibit in the break of the wall that shows the panoramic photograph of the land in front of the sunken road. Click forward to the next track on your player, and we'll continue. The photograph in this exhibit was taken from the heights to your right rear. It shows both the southern end of the sunken road, the section of the road you walked to get here, and also the vast expanse of open space that stood in front of the sunken road in Stonewall in December of 1862. Now, this photograph shows that land as being virtually unused, untouched. There's nary a fence or a building, except for the Stratton House, visible in the entire open plain, what would become the killing fields of December 1862. But in fact, before the Civil War, this field was, at least once a year, a bustling place. This was the site of the Fredericksburg Fairgrounds. In 1860, Fredericksburg's fair was already entering its 122nd year of existence. It was an ancient tradition and a focal point of the community. Every year in October or November, local newspapers counted down the days to the coming of the fair. Now, the fair then was a little bit different than the fair we know today. In fact, prior to the Civil War, fairs of this sort were a combination of the fun fests that we know fairs to be today, but also they were trade shows of a sort, where manufacturers, farmers, businessmen showed off their wares, their products, and where people came from all around, in this case from Fredericksburg, and from Spotsylvania County, and from Stafford County, to see what was the latest. Of course, part of the social fun of the fair was the plethora of pies and other things that would be on display. In fact, in 1858, awards at the Fredericksburg Fair were given for everything from livestock to peaches to syrup and Chinese sugar, Negro cloth, barrel flour, ladies' shoes, cigars, and even pressed brick. The newspaper noted in 1857, a lot of lard exhibited by Mrs. Joseph Alsop would doubtless have won a premium for its brightness, cleanness, and sweetness. We don't often see lard judged at fairs today, certainly. There were two great highlights of the fair. Each fair included a keynote address, usually by a local prominent politician, and these often went on for 2 or 3 hours. The other great highlight, which concluded the fair each year, was the tournament. From 3,000 to 4,000 people would often gather in this field to watch the young men of the community conduct horse races, mock jousting, and other activities intended to demonstrate their athletic ability and manliness. The winner of the fair's tournament got to make the selection of the most anticipated award of the entire event, and that was the selection of the Queen of Love and Beauty. The Queen of Love and Beauty each year was the great celebrity who emerged from the fair, the young woman in the community adjudged the most appealing, attractive, and womanly. The list of the Queens of Love and Beauty include the daughters of some of the most prominent families in all of Fredericksburg and Spotsylvania. All vestiges of these Fredericksburg fairgrounds were wiped away by war in 1862. The fences, the enclosures for livestock, the buildings for the display of pies and shirts and brogans, all destroyed in the combat of December 13th, 1862. After the Civil War, as Fredericksburg rebuilt and tried to reconstitute itself, the fair would return to this site for several years. And indeed, the fair continues still, now on a site south of town. It is, in all likelihood, the oldest continuously operating community fair in all of America. As for the fairgrounds, after the war, they would eventually be sold off to local developers. Most of the houses in the neighborhood in front of you date from about 1900 to about 1940. From here, continue along the sunken road to the site of the Martha Stevens House on your right-hand side. Turn your player back on when you reach that location. You should be standing in front of the site of the Martha Stevens House, marked out on the ground by a pattern of flat stones. If you went by the inscription on the stone monument that stands in front of the house, you might conclude that Martha Stevens was like thousands of other women on both sides who cared for the wounded during the Civil War. She did indeed apparently care for the wounded, but there the similarity to most other 19th century women ends. At the time of the Civil War, Martha Stevens was in her mid-30s. She had several children. She was in her second marriage. That was unusual enough, but in fact, both of Martha Stevens' marriages were common law, In other words, she had lived long enough with an unmarried man that the law recognized that they were married. Martha Stevens was fiercely independent, even brazen at times. She was, in the house that once stood on this spot, charged with running an illegal saloon. She was also cited for operating a grocery here without the proper license. Martha Stevens was often seen in and around town smoking a pipe, an unwomanly thing to do at the time, for sure. She occasionally was noted to be in the presence of African-American men. There was all sorts of speculation about her character. After the war, one man remembered her as a woman of abandoned character and said that she was an outcast of society. A more sympathetic observer said simply of her that she was uneducated, too free and too outspoken in what she said and how she said it. It's not surprising, then, that some people looked askance at Martha Stevens. She clearly lived both physically and societally on the fringes of the town of Fredericksburg. Still, she would become one of the most famous women associated with the Battle of Fredericksburg. On the morning of December 13th, Union troops swept across the fields beyond the house toward the stone wall, and Martha Stevens' house was literally in the middle of the battlefield. Confederate generals used the upstairs as a lookout. Confederate hospital workers cared for wounded in the downstairs. Confederate infantrymen even scrambled up on top of the house and used the peak of the house as a breastwork as they fired from above down into the field beyond. At the end of the battle, one man recorded that the house had at least 2,000 bullet holes in it. Now, where Martha Stevens was during all this, we can't be certain. Nobody who was on the field that day mentioned her at the time. But later, years later, in fact, the stories began to make the rounds that Martha Stevens had cared for Confederate wounded. The origin of those stories? Likely Martha Stevens herself, but nonetheless, her role as a caregiver to Confederate wounded became part of the lore of the battle. After the battle, Martha Stevens resumed her life as entrepreneur and sometime opportunist. One account says that she squatted, moved into the elegant trappings at Brompton for a time after the battle. Another source says quite clearly that she moved into the more substantial Stratton House, the brick Stratton House, just a couple blocks away, and lived there for several years at the end of the war. She continued to wheel and deal in the real estate market, at least to a degree, buying and selling land for several years. When she died in 1883, she was widely recognized in the local newspapers as something of a celebrity and a heroine, though a quirky one. We have a penchant for defining people in singular ways, as heroines, as outcasts. In fact, Martha Stevens is one of those people who clearly is more complex than we would like her to be. It's impossible to pigeonhole her as heroine or outcast. In fact, she was probably some of both. From here, continue on down the path to the frame Innes House. As you walk along the path to the Innes House, note the marker on your right, which locates the Stevens Family Cemetery. Martha Stevens, along with seven or eight others, is buried here. This is the Innes House, a witness to battle on December 13, 1862. It's important for that reason, of course, but it's also important because it's a rare surviving example of the type of house that most people lived in at the time of the Civil War. It's not palatial, it's not grand, it's not on a hill. It's a simple frame structure along a busy street. The house was probably brand new at the time of the Civil War, built probably in 1860 or 1861 by Martha Stevens, who lived next door. This was one of several lots and properties that Martha Stevens owned in this area. We know almost nothing about the occupants or experience of the house in the battle or even after the battle. It's likely that the resident of the house at the time of the war was Martha Stevens' son, a man named John Innes. We know nothing of his whereabouts, of his activities during the battle itself. We presume that he fled for the house that bears his name would become a focal point of the fighting along the sunken road in December of 1862. If you look closely at the outside of the house, you can see several holes in sidings and in window frames. These are almost certainly surviving bullet holes from the fighting during the Battle of Fredericksburg. Far more spectacular than the damage on the outside of the house is the damage on the inside of the house. In fact, if you peek in the windows, and we encourage you to do so, look at the partition that separates the main living space from the entry hallway. That partition is riddled with bullet holes. In fact, it's possible that the Innes House has more interior battle damage than any house in America. When the National Park Service received the Innes House in the 1970s, there was almost no visible battle damage at all. It was only when architects and workers started to look more closely at the house and its interior in the 1980s and began to peel away some of the plaster on that interior partition that they discovered the bullet holes. Looking closely, you can see from which direction each bullet comes. Most are from the Union side, which goes to figure. Some, though, are from the Confederate side as well. Now, as you look at that bullet-scarred partition, recognize that that partition runs parallel to the line of fire. So imagine what must have been the condition of the walls that stood perpendicular to the line of fire, that received the brunt of the fire on that day. It's easy to conceive that the Innes House, like the Stevens House, probably at one time had thousands of bullet holes in it. The house must have been repaired extensively after the war, because today on the outside, as I mentioned, only a few bullet holes are visible. After the Civil War, the wartime experience of this house was largely forgotten. It was used as a typical city residence up until the 1970s. From here, we're going to return back into the sunken road. Proceed down the road until you come to the exhibit for Brompton on the left-hand side of the road. Once there, turn your player back on. On the heights above you is Brompton, one of the most magnificent antebellum residences in all of Fredericksburg. At the time of the Civil War, this was the home of John L. Marie. It was Marie's name that would be given to the heights that would be made so famous by the Battle of Fredericksburg, the heart of the Confederate position here. Marie was a lawyer and an entrepreneur. He not only ran a prosperous law practice in and around town, but he also owned and operated a major mill down on the river next to the railroad tracks. Brompton was a frequent destination for visitors of all sorts. The building was built about 1820 and looks today much as it did at that time, except for the large gabled portico on it. At the time of the Civil War, that portico had a flat roof. Brompton was the heart of a 780-acre farm. Marie owned about 14 slaves to operate that farm and his industries as well. He was prominent in Virginia politics. In 1861, he would be the Fredericksburg region's delegate to the secession convention in Richmond. He went twice. The first time he voted against secession, the second time after Fort Sumter, he voted for it. The war would bring great woe to Brompton. Marie evacuated the place as the armies approached, and the armies would put the place to constant use. During the Battle of Fredericksburg, James Longstreet had his headquarters in the house. Earthworks scarred the front yard. Indeed, if you look at the stone wall at the base of the hill just in front of you, to your right, you'll see earthworks behind that wall as well. During the fighting on December 13, 1862, Confederate artillery boomed from the yard. Union bullets spattered the house. The photograph on the exhibit in front of you clearly shows the marks of dozens of bullets on the brickwork. In 1864, during the Battle of the Wilderness in Spotsylvania, Brompton was turned into a Union hospital. A Union surgeon left a vivid description of what he saw here.
Even the entries of this old mansion were crowded with sick and dying men. No available space was left unoccupied. The poor fellows just arrived had not had their clothes off since they were wounded, and they were sleeping in blood and filth, and were swarming with vermin. They lay as close as they could be packed, the contaminated air growing worse every hour. The openings in the torn and battered walls assisted somewhat in the ventilation.
During its use as a hospital in 1864, Brompton was the subject of one of the most famous series of photographs ever taken during the war. A Union photographer moved around the grounds, taking pictures of Union wounded, recording the landscape at the same time. These photographs are readily available online, and we urge you to pay a visit to the Library of Congress's website to view some of these images. Spending some time on that site is well worth the effort. After the war, burial crews disinterred 19 Union soldiers from the grounds of Brompton and reburied them in the National Cemetery. Two Confederate soldiers were found there as well. They are buried in the Confederate Cemetery on Washington Avenue today. For much of the war after the Battle of Fredericksburg, it's likely that Martha Stevens lived at Brompton, perhaps with Marie's permission, acting as something of an overseer for the place. Brompton would survive the war, and soon after the war would reclaim its place as one of the most elegant living spaces in all of Fredericksburg. Nearly 100 years later, Brompton was purchased by what was then Mary Washington College, and today it is the home of the president of the University of Mary Washington. Its elegance is a great contrast to the simplicity of the Innes House and reflects the great gap that often existed between the South's aristocracy and the more common residents. Before we move on to the Ebert House, turn around and look at what is the only surviving original section of the stone wall that lined the sunken road. In fact, in this section of the road, both the original west wall and the east wall survive. It gives you a great sense of how wide the road corridor was. In fact, the road through this corridor generally only took up 12 or 15 feet, but the width of the corridor allowed travelers to meander to avoid puddles or other obstructions. The sunken road was hardly a very neat place. It was rutted, rocky, often scattered with the excrement of horses, a far cry from a modern superhighway. But a superhighway it was for its day, one of the most important roads linking Fredericksburg to places south. From here, continue on down the road about 25 yards to the exhibit marking the site of the Ebert House. You should be standing in front of the exhibit for the Ebert House, outlined by the flat foundation stones in front of you. A couple of things about this site. First off, the Courthouse Road, the Telegraph Road, the Sunken Road, in fact, turned into Fredericksburg here, passing in front of the Ebert House along what is today Kirkland Street. Today, it dead ends there, but historically, the road and the stone wall actually continued on toward town for some distance. In fact, if you look closely, you can see that on the west side of the road, the stone wall in front of Brompton is bowed a little bit, pushed inward. There's an indentation. That was put there to allow for a wider turning radius for large wagons making the turn into town here. The sunken road hardly at all continued over to Hanover Street. At the time of the Civil War, this was essentially just a footpath here, the main road instead going down what is today Kirkland Street. Now to the house itself, the Ebert House, or sometimes as it was known after the war as the Battle House, presumably in reference to the battle. Henry and Sophia Ebert moved in here about 1858. They'd been in Fredericksburg for more than a decade. Both were born in Germany. In fact, the Eberts were part of a very important and robust community of Germans who had moved to Fredericksburg in the 1840s and 50s. The German community here ran many businesses. Several confectionaries in town, in fact, were run by Germans. And John G. Herkamp, who ran a tannery just a few hundred yards from here, would become, in the post-war years, one of the most prominent Fredericksburgers of all. But Henry and Sophia Ebert and their children lived rather quietly here on this little turn in the road in this little story and a half high, whitewashed building. Now, Henry Ebert was an entrepreneur. He ran, from this small house, a grocery intended to serve both passers-by on the sunken road, but also for the small grouping of residents who lived and worked along the sunken road and along nearby Hanover Street. In fact, all told, there were more than a dozen houses clustered out here in what was Fredericksburg's first suburb. As the battle approached, like most Fredericksburg families, the Eberts fled the immediate battlefield area, spending time apparently out in Spotsylvania County. When they returned, they found the landscape around their house a wreck. Their neighbor, Alan Stratton, whose orchard nearly backed up to the Eberts' house, had seen his fences and landscape virtually wiped out by the presence of the Union battle lines in his yard. The Yankees never reached the Ebert house, of course, but the Ebert house found itself very much in the line of fire. The Eberts, or their children or descendants, would live in this house until 1944. The house was in good condition in the 1950s, but apparently nobody wanted it, and in 1957 it was torn down, one of the great losses of a historic building on the Fredericksburg battlefield. In the 1960s, a local developer planned to put an apartment complex for the Ebert lot, including the site where the Kirkland Memorial now stands. In fact, the bulldozers started to build, but soon after, Mary Washington College intervened and bought the land. In 1965, the college oversaw the construction of the Kirkland Memorial. Their efforts to preserve this piece of ground and to see to the commemoration of Richard Kirkland's brave act of mercy on the Fredericksburg battlefield is one of the great lasting contributions to preservation in Fredericksburg. Throughout much of the time that the Ebert family lived here after the war, they continued to operate a small grocery store out of this house. In fact, it became a popular stop-off for local children to pick up a gingerbread cookie or a piece of candy as they moved in and out of town. Today, nothing remains but the flat stone foundation put in by the National Park Service to mark the site in 2005. The story of the Eberts, like the story of most of the civilians who lived on or near the sunken road during the Civil War, has been largely forgotten. From here, we'll make one more stop on our walk along the sunken road. As you return back along the sunken road, stop at the exhibit on the right-hand side of the road, just beyond the Cobb Memorial, which is opposite the Stevens House site. There, we'll talk about the restoration and reclamation of the road in 2004 and 2005. You should now be standing in front of the exhibit that includes the famous photograph of the sunken road taken probably just minutes after the fighting ended here during the Second Battle of Fredericksburg in May of 1863. This has become one of the iconic images of the entire Civil War. As you stand here today looking at this scene, looking at the restored road, it's hard to imagine that in 2002 this was just another city street. Harder still to imagine is that in the 1920s and 30s and 40s, houses lined the left-hand side of the road. The stone walls were long gone, and there was hardly any vestige, other than the Cobb Monument, of what had happened here all those years before. But still, the history lingered. Since the construction of the visitor center along the sunken road in the 1930s, the National Park Service had always expressed interest in giving visitors better access and understanding to what had happened along the sunken road. It was in the 1930s that they built the reproduction section of stone wall that stands near the visitor center. But still, this was a city street. That is, until 2003. That year, City Council finally determined to close the road to traffic and to turn it over to the National Park Service in its entirety. With that, the National Park Service had the opportunity to reclaim a lost resource. The effort to do that was no easy task, with great uncertainty and a lot we did not know. Reclaiming or restoring the sunken road involved three major components. First, we were anxious to mark and interpret key sites along the road, including the sites you've seen today, Innes, Stevens, Ebert. The second component of the restoration involved the restoration of the stone walls. The stone walls along the sunken road had been removed for some reason during the decades after the Civil War. We don't know why. We don't know where the stone was taken or how it was reused. Archaeologists discovered the footers to the wall, though, and so we know exactly where that wall stood. We knew how wide it was. Indeed, the current wall was built on top of the surviving footers of the original, which we left undisturbed. The most important source in the reconstruction of the stone wall by far is the photograph in front of you. If you look, for example, at that musket leaning against the wall, we know exactly what kind of musket that is. We can measure the angle at which it lies against the wall. We know how long the musket is. And by doing those calculations, we were able to determine exactly how tall the wall was. The stone workers were good at recapturing the look of the wall as well. Photographs of the section of the wall north of the Stevens house show that the stonework was not as fine. The stones were smaller. And if you compare the wall here, immediately to your left, to the wall on the other side of the Stevens house, you'll see that the stoneworkers captured those differences almost perfectly. The reconstructed wall here took about 6 weeks to build. The third component of the restoration of the road involved reestablishing an appropriate surface. That's no small challenge in an area where we knew tens of thousands of visitors would be walking every year. We needed something that was durable and something that would look good. We ended up looking at more than 25 different surfaces, but in the end, we retreated back in history. We ended up using a common dirt mixture. It's carefully mixed, it's carefully measured for sure, but it is nothing more than a dirt road. The current road lies about 6 to 12 inches above the level of the original road. We made a commitment early on that we did not want to disturb the original surface of the road, the archaeological remains of that road, which still exist. And so we concluded to build everything on top of it, above that level. And so today, the modern road is a few inches higher than its historic counterpart. The result is, I think, one of the prettiest places in Fredericksburg and one of the most compelling places on any Civil War battlefield in America. The sunken road has gone full circle, from what was probably a cart path in colonial days to a significant highway in the years before the Civil War, to hallowed ground on December 13, 1862, to city street, to neighborhood, and now back to a historic resource of compelling power. But a constant all along the way are the people who lived here. And we hope that our walk today has illuminated for you not only the people who lived along this road, but the vivid experiences these people and all Fredericksburgers had as they struggled to survive America's most difficult period, the American Civil War. This concludes the tour. You can return to the parking lot by walking about 100 yards and passing through the break in the stone wall and down the path toward the visitor center. We do thank you very much for coming today. We hope you've enjoyed our outing today along the sunken road, and we hope you also take advantage of the other podcasts that we have available. We'll be constantly creating and updating them over the next many years and hope you'll visit us often. Thank you once again.